You are listening to Latin Waves, a weekly syndicated program. For more information about our program, visit www.latinwavesmedia.com. Latin Waves Media is also now available on Twitter at Twitter/Latin Waves Media.
Dr. Jensen is a professor. He teaches media, law, ethics, and politics at the University of Texas at Austin. His books include Getting Off, The Heart of Whiteness, Citizen of Empire, and Riding Dissent. And of course, your latest book, All My Bones Shake.
Great to be here, Sylvia. Thanks.
Now, our show is it's a show that focuses on issues of community. And one of the things that we often neglect to talk about is inequality and how inequality is structured. You are someone who have written extensively on the subject, and as a reporter, as a journalist, you follow many of the stories. So let's talk a little bit about that inequality in our society we don't often equate with racist policies.
Well, the relationship between inequality and racism is quite clear. Let's just do a quick thought experiment. Let's say you had a family of six, you know, two parents, four kids, sitting around the dinner table, and you saw that one of the children is eating 50% less. You had one out of those four children that was not having access to the food required. Well, what would you do? Well, you'd immediately would rectify the situation because of a simple fact. You see all four of those children as of equal value, of having the same humanity in a sense. Now, take that to a larger platform. If you have a society in which one group of people are systematically deprived of access to those things that make life possible. In other words, if you have disparities in the access to wealth, to the things we need to live, if you treated people equally, you would say, well, immediately we've got to rectify the situation so everybody has at least access to the minimal requirements for a decent life. But we don't do that. And one of the reasons we don't do that is we live in a society in which the humanity of some groups of people is in fact not assumed to be equal. Now, I'm not saying that we all walk around with an overtly racist agenda or that we espouse an overtly racist ideology, but I think the dominant white culture in the United States, that's the culture derived from the Europeans who eventually conquered the entire continent and made it their own, people like me, white Americans, still struggle to see the full humanity of other groups, and that's why inequality persists. Let's be very clear. The data is not controversial here. There is a racialized gap in what I call the measures of wealth and well-being, the indicators of how well people are doing in a society, things like high school graduation, employment, infant mortality, access to health care. On all of these measures, there is a racialized gap in the United States between white and non-white America, and that racialized gap is particularly pronounced, for instance, between white and black America. Now, in the almost six decades now since the Civil Rights Movement, that racialized gap persists. And that tells me that the society in which we live does not recognize the full humanity of those groups. So the inequality is there, it's well documented, and I think that inequality is allowed to exist because of that racism, or more accurately, I think, white supremacy that continues to structure American society.
When I talk about this in my class, immediately most students say, well, I'm not racist. I have friends who are Mexicans and I have friends who are from Africa, so I'm not a racist. So how is it possible to have a racist society with racist policies, as you point out, that gap is racialized, without having racist when everybody is inclusive?
Several things to say. Let's remember, first of all, that a significant chunk of the United States does not even espouse racial equality. There is still an overtly white supremacist segment of the United States. We're used to seeing it only in the fringe these days, you know, the Klan or neo-Nazi groups or overtly white supremacist groups. But when we see it popping up in not such camouflaged ways in things like the Tea Party movement, we can recognize that there's still a segment of the United States that basically believes white people are better. That's number one. Number two, those of us who reject white supremacy, who do not believe in the superiority of white people, we were still socialized in a world based on white supremacy, and a lot of research indicates the way in which that lingers in us. This is what we can call unconscious racism, the way in which people who will articulate a non-racist politics still find themselves in ways that we are truly unconscious. We can't really control it all the time. We'll make judgments about people based on race. Sociologists and psychologists have been studying this for quite a while now, and the evidence is pretty clear. So there's an unconscious racism we carry. And beyond that, no matter what individuals believe, we're talking here about a structure with a history and a contemporary practice. Take the question of accumulation of wealth. Well, white folks who've had access to wealth and power for much longer often within a family accumulate wealth, which is then passed down generation to generation. Non-white families, especially African-American, indigenous families, Latino families, have not had the same time of even legal equality to amass wealth like that and pass it down. So you see this sort of structural racism. So again, there can be openly racist people. There can be non-racist people who still struggle with internalized racism. And then there's the reality of the structure and all of that. That's the world in which we live. There's nothing inconsistent with observing that people often are crossing racial boundaries easier in friendships, for instance, at least in certain classes. And it's also, you know, true that everything else I just said is a reasonable account of society. So take my students at the University of Texas. There's much more mixing among racial and ethnic groups among students today than when I started teaching 20 years ago. That's true. But that doesn't obscure any of the facts I've just laid out on the table either.
2010 marks the centennial anniversary of the revolution in Mexico, where the population, the indigenous population and mestizo population, fought against the landowners, the primarily Spaniards landowners, and were able to garnish some benefits like the ejidos, lands that were collectively farmed and, you know, provided access to land and resources that people need for survival. The same story can be told of 200 years ago when they emancipated themselves, in theory at least, from the Spaniards' hold, right, where they became a sovereign country. And in the States, we have the same narrative. You know, we threw the English out and the American people became a country for themselves. So this colonial attitudes that still remain today that justify inequality provide a very convenient narrative of who is poor and who is rich in society. And the narrative we're told is that people who work hard, who are innovative, are able to succeed. How does this fuel the fundamentalisms that you speak of in your book?
Well, first of all, the history, the way you presented that history is, of course, the conventional way we hear it in the United States. The only problem is it's not very accurate. The United States did not liberate itself from a colonial power. What happened is one group of the conquerors who had issues with another group of the conquerors fought for control, and a particular faction won out in what became the United States. And then that faction, what we call our founding fathers, Washington, Adams, you know, Jefferson and the boys, what they did is they proceeded to consolidate their power by eliminating the indigenous population, eventually across the entire continent, by building up an economy based on slave labor, and to the degree possible, becoming an empire as soon as it could project power. So, you know, it's true that there's a certain inspirational quality to the way that the colonial subjects in the United States, what became the United States, broke away from England. There's a lot in the Declaration of Independence and the U.S. Constitution that can be admired. But we shouldn't confuse that with a sort of anti-colonial revolution. It was simply one group of colonizers replacing another group in charge over a process that would eventually decimate the continent, both in social and ecological terms. And there's nothing to be celebrated in that. All right, well, that's one reality to get clear about. And if we did get clear about then what we're calling the kind of national fundamentalism, the belief in the United States as, you know, a country that can do no wrong, would immediately erode. The other fundamentalism especially relevant here is, of course, market fundamentalism or economic fundamentalism, the belief that capitalism provides a level playing field for all to compete and that the people who succeed are those who are smarter and work harder. Well, the problem with that is it's contradicted by all the evidence. Everybody who's listening knows someone who's bright and works hard and does not succeed in the system, because the system is not a level playing field. The system is set up to advantage some and disadvantage others. The concentration of wealth throughout the history of the United States, especially dramatic in recent years, has given some people the power to set the rules of the game and undermine the ability of others to compete and to you know, succeed. And so that narrative has to be disrupted. And we have to ask an even more fundamental question about capitalism is, why do we want to build a system, an economic system, that encourages competition instead of cooperation? Why do we want to create a system that, in a sense, exacerbates the worst of human nature, the human instinct for greed and self-aggrandizement? That's true. Human beings have a greedy nature. We often only pursue our self-interest, but that's not the only thing human beings are. Human beings, of course, are also capable of incredible compassion, selflessness, acting in the interests of others. And so what we've done is build an economic system that exacerbates the worst of our nature and represses the best of our nature. We're told by people with control that all of this is inevitable. It's just the way it has to be. Well, of course, anytime anybody claims that human choices that distribute power and wealth in one way are natural, the first thing you know is that you're being conned, that there's nothing natural about it. And in fact, we could choose differently, and there have been political movements for centuries advocating that we indeed choose differently.
We know today that more than half the world population lives on, you know, less than $10 a day. And we read these reports almost as natural. You know, the injustice has become so naturalized that we no longer even question it. Right now, we're talking about climate change and the incredible impact this will have on populations, coastal populations, people who live in areas that are becoming arid by over-exploitation of the natural resources, by clear-cutting of forests and overfishing of our waters. We know this, and yet we fail to act. We have leaders like President Bush, who at the 1992 Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro declared, the American way of life is non-negotiable. So how do we then create or redefine a way of looking at life, of creating a culture where we can live well rather than live better, rather than constantly be in this endless consumption race?
Well, first of all, just to go back to the statistic you cited, it's actually a little grimmer than you suggested. The World Bank keeps statistics on global income and such, and about half the world's population lives on less than $2.50 a day, U.S. currency. That means half the world, that's over 3 billion people, of course, live on less than what some in the United States might spend on a fancy cup of coffee. That's abject poverty. That's 3 billion people without access to the means for even a minimally decent life. And that's the reality of the world today. To go back to our earlier discussion, we know that the people who are in that bottom half of the world's population are disproportionately non-white, living in what we call the third world, the less developed world. We also know they're disproportionately female. So we can see here how a system of global capitalism imposed by imperial states like the United States or the European countries, the states that have run the world for most of the last five centuries, we know that that economic system, which plays out in a white supremacist and patriarchal world, a world that's dominated by the ideology of white supremacy, white superiority, and patriarchy, of male dominance. We know who's going to suffer most in that world, and it's quite clear. As you point out, it's now beyond a concern only about justice within the human family. We are degrading the ecosystem that makes our own lives possible at a rate that I think now puts on the table the question of how long large-scale human life as we know it can exist on this planet. Well, all of that's pretty dramatic, and you think human beings would get together and say, okay, it's time for quite radical shift in the way we define our lives. And as you point out, that's exactly what's not happening, at least at the level of conventional politics. You mentioned the first George Bush presidency. Of course, Bill Clinton proposed basically the same approach, that we have to, you know, sort of remain committed to this so-called American dream of affluence and consumption. And the second George Bush presidency was no different, nor is the presidency of Barack Obama any different. Barack Obama tends to be a slightly more rational human being, I think, than his predecessor. But Barack Obama has done nothing to move the world or the United States, or, you know, to even an awareness of the stakes that we're playing with. So the conventional political system, I think, at this point is simply incapable of that kind of acknowledgement and awareness and action, which means that the real action, from my point of view, is not within the conventional political arena. It's on the ground, very grassroots and very local. It's in small-scale experiments with different ways of not only living, but defining our own humanity. Just to give you an example, I'm involved in several projects in Austin where mostly younger people, I find that young people have the better ideas these days, quite frankly, are involved in those kind of experiments. I'm working with a group that's helping create and develop worker-owned, worker-run businesses, businesses in which decisions are made democratically, not in a hierarchy like in the corporations that we often live in. Groups working on immigrant rights, trying to connect issues around economic justice to national and ethnic identities as well. Groups that forefront the importance of gender and making sure that, that women have a voice in all of this. To me, this is where the real excitement is. When I look at, you know, the upcoming midterm elections, you know, I'll vote, and I don't want to discount the importance of voting, but it seems to me that that vote is probably one of the least important political acts in my life. That, in fact, the way I apportion my time, energy, and money at this local level is where the action really is.
Well, we are not told a true historical account of the colonization. We're also not told the stories of people who are creating alternatives to this economic model that displaces and lives out so many millions of people. In Bolivia, for instance, many of the indigenous communities are now taking their own communities into their hands. So it's not a voting practice, but more of a participatory democracy where people actually participate in creating those decisions. Filmmaker Raul Burbano says the concept of indigenous is different from ours. They see life as a way to find bien vivir, the difference between buen vivir and bien vivir, which is well-being and living better. Living better means, you know, more consumption, racing with the Joneses, whereas, you know, living well means living in balance, living within the constraints of the natural environment. What do we do? How do we claim that prophetic voice, and how do we prepare ourselves for the challenges that we face when we do speak?
Well, I think you're right. Let's go back to Bolivia. It's a very exciting society in a lot of ways. Listeners may know that someone from an indigenous community, Evo Morales, was elected president. But the complexity of Bolivia is also very important. There are the kind of movements on the ground that you're talking about, trying to recreate Bolivia. But there's also indications now that the Morales administration is pursuing kind of traditional development policies, maybe policies that hope to share the wealth more equitably in the society, but still see the earth in kind of industrial terms, you know, or earth as something to be mined. There's actually a lot of, I think, interesting activity in Bolivia that's kind of off the radar of those of us in the United States, in which indigenous people are actually challenging Morales to not accept the traditional global conception of development that comes out of this industrial capitalism model. So all sorts of exciting things going on. In rough terms, I think you're right. We have a competition now between two basic ways of looking at the world. One is this industrial model that came out of Europe, came out of the Enlightenment, came out of the scientific revolutions. And whatever the value of the scientific revolutions and the Enlightenment in helping us understand the world better, and the contributions are quite enormous, this industrial model that sees the earth as a mine from which we extract what we want and then a dumping ground into which we put the waste products, that model is coming to an end. It simply isn't sustainable. Yet we've created societies that are kind of addicted to the consumption that comes from that model. On the other hand, there are deeply rooted traditions in indigenous communities and from other traditions, spiritual traditions, that see the human relationship to the earth, as you point out, of one in which we strive for balance, in which the quality of life is not judged by the amount of consumption. Well, that tradition, of course, is sort of defines indigenous communities, and you can also see strands of it in Christianity and other European history. So it's a complicated world, but in a way, I think you're right. It's one or the other. Either we return to the way humans historically lived for hundreds of thousands of years, which was in small-scale communities, generally in hunting and gathering economies, that were in a kind of rough balance with the earth. We either return to that model or we die. I think it's quite simple. Now, the problem, of course, is there are 6.7 billion people on the earth right now, and no one imagines we're going to return to some hunting-gathering societies of the past. There's simply too many of us around. So we've got a real challenge in this transition period. And so it's not about simplistically asserting we're going to go back to some old way of doing things. But the question is, how can we use the principles and the practices that come out of that old way of doing things to transition to some world that's sustainable at this level? And I personally am not terribly optimistic about this. The challenges are incredible. Just the technical challenges of how to do that are incredible. But when those challenges are faced within a political and social environment in which big chunks of the population essentially are sticking their heads in the sand and saying, we don't even want to think about this, it means the political will to move forward is not yet present. And that's, again, why I think these small-scale, local, grassroots experiments are so important, because they can go forward without, you know, a great shift at the national political level. You, on the ground, you can go forward with all sorts of exciting and creative work. And it's from that work, I think, that the new ideas are going to emerge. They're not going to emerge from Barack Obama or any particular political party or any particular think tank. They're going to emerge from ordinary people who sense what the stakes are and apply themselves to trying to move us forward.
I think you're speaking to a community who sees spirituality as a central component of their lives, but you're also speaking to a general population who wants to create a different society, more equitable. And you address some of the myths that hold us hostage, I think, you know, this naturalization of poverty and the exoticization of violence that is so prevalent in our society. Can we move forward without addressing our biases, the privilege that seems to be invisible to most white, you know, well-to-do rich people who don't see that, you know, they're participant in promoting this inequitable world that makes war natural, that makes poverty natural, that, you know, looks at injustice as the new normal?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of important issues in what you just brought up. So let's go back to religious and spiritual traditions. You know, the New Testament does include this statement. I think it's in the book of Matthew, if I remember right. The poor will always be with you. Well, that means not that poverty is natural or inevitable. It means that as long as we live in a world that is out of right relation with our own principles, if our spirit is out of whack in that sense, then yes, there will be poverty. But the whole point of the New Testament is a call to a different way of living. And in that, if we could transcend, poverty would not be inevitable. That reminds us of the kind of complexity of religious traditions. Take Christianity, the dominant tradition in the United States. It's, I think, a call to justice. If you read both the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament, a kind of relentless call to challenge hierarchy, power, inequality. Yet it's become a vehicle to justify power, hierarchy, inequality. You saw it quite clearly with Glenn Beck's event on the Washington Mall a couple of weeks ago, in which he was spinning a story in which this claim to American dominance, American power, American affluence, was being justified on biblical grounds. He was taking the same text that I might refer to and, from my point of view, flipping it on its head. That tells you something about the power of these myths that guide the United States. And this is not trivial, because Glenn Beck is trying to speak to a population in the United States that feels disaffected, that feels dishonored, that feels like their rightful place in the sun has been somehow tarnished, and scapegoating, looking for the people they can blame for that, is a very dangerous enterprise that people like Glenn Beck are engaged in. So there's a lot at stake here. The first step, as I think you're pointing out, is that we in the United States have to challenge ourselves. And all of the mythologies you're talking about, national mythologies, economic mythologies, racial mythologies, all of them try to keep the American population from making that connection to the world. So we have a lot of work. The work is both practical. We have to build institutions, political movements. The work is also, as you're pointing out, kind of ideological. We have to struggle to intervene in the way people think. It's a kind of question about storytelling. Who gets to tell the stories of what it means to be an American? Well, if we don't shift those stories, if we don't redefine what it means to be a citizen of the United States, I think we're in for much tougher times than we've seen so far.
Thank you so much for being with us. My guest is Dr. Robert Jensen, and his book, All My Bones Shake, marks a new communion, a way to put our spirituality to use as we create a sustainable society and to meet the uncertainty of our lives with greater confidence. Reading from your book. It's a beautiful book. I highly recommend it. How can people access your book?
Well, the easiest place is to order it, of course, from independent booksellers in your city. That's what we always want to support, those folks out there who are still maintaining independent bookstores. But it's also available online. If listeners just Google my name, Robert Jensen, they'll find a list of all of these and places they can find them.
Thank you again for being with us.
Always a pleasure, Sylvia. Thanks so much.
Take care.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.